Melanie has a name.
So.
Okay, welcome. Let me call to order the meeting of the Legislation Committee. We have present here more than a quorum.
Wow.
We have legislators Burgeon, Ryan, A. Williams, Harkam. Welcome back, Peter.
Thank you.
Pinto, Myers, and myself, John Nona. And so we're going to get started. On our agenda today is an item that has been the subject of much prior discussion, and that's a proposed law to ban discrimination based upon source of income in the rental of housing. I thought I would start by kind of summarizing some of the prior proceedings. We have had four prior, at least since 2009, and I think there was some discussion of this law prior to that in prior years, but at least within 1 year, 2009, we had four meetings of the Legislation Committee in which this law was discussed. Changes were made to the original draft, including making it inapplicable to buildings with four or fewer apartments subject to some other qualifications. The law was amended to provide that while source of income could not be considered, level of income could be considered, and there's some criteria for that. And we added as a defense for a landlord that the landlord exercised his or her reasonable business judgment. We also had two public hearings on this proposed law. There were approximately 35 or 36 speakers at each hearing, and my notes indicate they were about evenly divided for and against. We've had landlord and tenant groups express views at the meeting and at public hearings. We've had a tenant group study showing landlords refusing to accept Section 8. We've had a landlord survey of 100 questionnaires with about 30 responses, which looked like about 15 were positive and 15 were negative regarding their views of proposed or their views of Section 8 tenants and the Section 8 program. And we had a number of issues raised regarding how, not directly concerned with the law, but relating to how the Section 8 program is administered. Where we are now is at the during the last legislative session, the proposed law was recommitted and not voted on by the board. And based upon all the discussions, we know there's some basic philosophical differences here that probably will never be resolved. I mean, there's one school of thought that believes that source of income or prohibition of discrimination against source of income is an appropriate subject for the Westchester County Fair Housing Law to prevent discrimination based upon source of income, and there's some data to support the conclusion that there is discrimination based upon source of income, particularly Section 8 voucher holders, and evidence to indicate that the opportunities for obtaining apartments for Section 8 voucher holders are restricted. There is also another school of thought that believes it is not appropriate to restrict the landlord's right to choose, and that this law would overly restrict the landlord's right to decide whom to rent an apartment to. And this group believes that Section 8 is a, points out the fact that Section 8 is a voluntary program under federal law. I would note that courts have held that source of income laws enacted by state and local governments are not preempted by federal law, Federal Fair Housing Act. We made changes to the law to, as I mentioned, to allow for landlords to consider the level of income and exercise business judgment. There's some philosophical differences I don't think can be resolved, but what we can try to determine, and we've spent a lot of time on this already, but I think it's worth spending more time and making a decision one way or the other. But the issue I think we should consider is whether there's some common ground that would protect Section 8 voucher holders and the need to create housing opportunity, while at the same time not overly restricting a landlord's property rights and freedom to choose tenants. And that's what we're trying to find out, if there's some common ground there. Some of the outstanding issues that I think are open and were not resolved in our prior meetings, one was the issue of whether cooperative apartments should be the subject of the law. The new draft that we've distributed provides for cooperative apartments to be excluded. We didn't deal with condos, but they should probably be excluded as well. And the question there is whether there was significant opposition to including cooperative apartments by cooperative groups, by cooperative boards and cooperative associations. And there seems to be evidence that Section 8 vouchers are not really very significantly used in the cooperative context. There were questions raised about the impact of passing this law on co-op boards, and some concerns expressed about the rising cost of directors and officers insurance for co-ops if they pass this law. So the current law excludes, the current draft of the proposed law excludes co-ops. We also deleted a reference to, in the definition of source of income, to inheritance, which we discussed last year, but in the rush to get it on for a public hearing, we decided not to exclude it. But the issue there is whether we should protect people from discrimination because they inherited money. I don't think we should, because the purpose of this law is not to, I don't think, to protect that source of income. But if people think otherwise, I'm sure we'll hear about it. Another issue that was discussed and not completely, I think, vetted was how Section 8 interacts with the Emergency Tenant Protection Act. And I think that issue relates to renewal of leases, whereas under the Section 8 program alone, if a lease expires, a landlord does not have to renew the lease and keep it in the Section 8 program. But if the ETPA applies and it's a rent-stabilized apartment, then under the Section 8 program, that becomes a term of the lease, and or rather the Section 8 program becomes a term of the lease, and a landlord must offer a renewal to a Section 8 tenant. And I think there's a New York Court of Appeals case called Rosario that's so held. There's also another issue of the ability of the landlord to terminate a lease at the end of the lease term under federal law. I think a landlord is allowed to do that, but would this law prevent the landlord from doing that? There's also a concern expressed that if we pass this law, there would be a surge of complaints before the Human Rights Division or our Human Rights Commission. Certainly at this point, I don't think there's there have not been those allegations. We are going to look to the experience in Nassau and New York City to try to get data as to whether upon passage of their source of income laws there was some dramatic increase in discrimination complaints. So these are some of the issues, but I open the floor for further questions and issues from the legislators and any other people, stakeholders, members of the public, to want to raise. I also wanted to begin, however, and I've asked the administration to come because I'd like to start with the administration's position on this proposed law. Is there anyone here from the administration that can speak?
Down in 5 minutes.
Okay. In the meantime, we'll start with legislators. Any questions, comments, thoughts, and then we'll open it up to general comments. Yes, Legislator Myers.
Where was the, trying to go back in my memory, the whole area that we got into about business decision making, where was that? That it was left up to the owners. We had language somehow.
Yeah, it's there. Section 4, let me see here. Section 3. This is not paginated, but Section 3, under, there's Roman numeral 5, source of income shall mean. And then there's a number of subdivisions. It's subdivision 4. It shall not constitute an unlawful discriminatory real estate practice on the basis of source of income that a housing accommodation was denied based on the use of by a person of his or her reasonable business judgment.
Okay. And that's okay.
Wasn't that one of the areas and one of the reasons why we didn't do co-ops? Because they have a board that has to approve a tenant moving into a co-op.
They do, yeah.
And they didn't want to have this as a reason that somebody could use, whereas they don't have to give reasons right now.
Well, Section 8 also doesn't apply to many co-ops.
Well, no. I think one of the issues the co-ops raised is this is putting an additional requirement onto their right to deny a proposed shareholder because I think the law is pretty liberal when it comes to the fact that a co-op board doesn't have to say anything when they reject the tenant.
Yes.
Or not a proposed shareholder. Anybody else on the board have any questions?
Business judgment.
If I can make a statement, I think the exclusion of co-ops and by extension condominiums is a major step in creating a compromise, one that I'm not necessarily comfortable with, but I'm willing to support because I believe we need to do this, and we need to do it sooner rather than later. When I was chair of this committee, we went through this four times, and I think each time we moved a step closer, but I think this is one of the major sticking points. I don't know that this is going to bring the real estate community in with this. Mr. Finger is smiling. But I do think that it could reduce the vehemence of opposition, at least I hope it would. But I think we've gone quite far with this draft. And I would hope that in the spirit of cooperation that both the administration and the industry would see their way clear to bring themselves into support or at least not oppose this law as it's now written.
Any other comments from Ms. Sayers?
Did you want to include condos?
We can ask them, but I remember that when the industry spoke last at several of the meetings that I attended as a member of GL, you know, their concern was that they had the right to at least make a decision based on business, and that was what they contended why we didn't need this, that they have the right to make a business decision, and they didn't want to have cases brought against them merely because somebody said my human rights have been violated because of a source of income, which the contention was source of income is not a human right, sex, gender, race, creed. And, you know, and I certainly understood some of their concerns.
The co-op?
No, this was just the real estate. And then there was the big contention about the thing. I think Tom's not here, but it was the four-unit and mom and pop.
Mrs. Murphy.
That's in there still.
It's there.
So that was some of the issues that came up. You know, if we're going to continue with comments and notice we have to set another public hearing again this year, you know, are we going to open up the meeting today to comments from the floor?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
In the meantime, I see our former colleague and current chief of staff to the county executive is here, George Oros, and we invited you down to express any views the administration might have on this proposed source of income law as amended. So would you please join us and share with us your thoughts or the administration's thoughts?
Welcome, George.
Welcome back.
Really, at this point, we have been in discussions, as you know, with the monitor and trying to address all the concerns that were raised in the implementation plan. And one of the items that was raised was this particular issue. And so, quite frankly, at this point, we, the county executive, as you may or may not know, has been away the last couple of days. We have not put together our full plan on this at this point in time until we've had an opportunity to go back to the monitor and talk about a few things. So at this point, I don't know that there's much more I could add to whatever you may or may not be doing with the legislation today. I don't know if your plans were to sign it out. You can't sign it out for today anyway.
Georgia would have to be signed up to set a public hearing at the next meeting date, which would, because we're beyond the 1:30, would go for next Monday's meeting.
Right.
Set a date for obviously the next meeting in March.
Well, we already have another public hearing coming up for March 22nd, so I think it probably would be for the next regular meeting of the board, which is April.
You don't want to have two in the same night.
No, so it could be. Well,
we could.
What's
the hearing?
We could.
Okay.
The next meeting is April 5th, so that's a possibility. But we can discuss that later.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
I can ask Mr. Roris, do you anticipate that the county executive will have a position in concept relatively soon?
Yes.
You will. Say by the 12th of March?
Because
we have the deadline for the IP on the 12th of March.
Yes, we do. Yes, and certainly we have to address everything that the monitor commented on. by March 12th that we're in the process of doing. So that's why at this point I'm not, we're working through some things, so at this point I'm not prepared really to say much more than that.
I think that's appropriate. I just wanted to...
Are you guys involved in it?
No.
The world has changed, so there is now potentially conflict between this board and the executive on this matter, and the executive's opinion matters rather substantially to us. Therefore, I would like to have some sense of this, and if the 12th of March is an appropriate time to look for that response, then I'd be appreciative of that.
Yes. As opposed to the 12th of Never, which is when we...
No. There's an old rock and roll song to take into account. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you, George. Okay. I'd like to open it up now to the public. Any questions or comments? You want to save it all for the public hearing? Yes.
No, I'd just like to echo what Legislator Burton said. I mean, I think that our side has made a number of concessions on this. I mean, we keep giving and giving and giving. I think as a public policy, needs to, as Bill also said, that let's move this. Let's get this on a fast track. We've been doing this not only for 2-3 years. I started this thing 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. This came out from a meeting that we had at the Martin Luther King annual event at Manhattanville College 5 years ago. I think we keep on giving. I think we know what the issues are. Everybody around this table knows what the housing situation is like. You've probably been given calls from your constituents on this. You probably have gotten previously about how difficult it is to get a unit with a Section 8 voucher. That's why they have the concentration in South Mount Vernon and Southwest Yonkers, because not a week goes by that I don't have somebody complaining they couldn't get out of it, to a different area. We think people should have that choice. I mean, Section 8 basically helps people with economic mobility and racial integration. So we should be doing that. I mean, I think it's a easy call on the rightness of the issue. I think we, our side has bent over backwards and been giving continuously.
Is Section 8 voucher still frozen?
Yes.
Is there any chance that'll get lifted and there'll be more of them available?
Oh, well, eventually. We don't know when, though.
Thanks.
Yes. John Shankin, Cluster Housing Resource Center. I actually just spoke with somebody today who had checked on her status. I had to help her 2 years ago. She was displaced because she got Section 8. This is a woman with her infirm mother, a working woman, who was in an ETPA property, actually, and paying over 50% of her income in rent, and that application number finally came up. And she was approved for Section 8, and the landlord informed her the landlord did not accept Section 8. And she had to relocate. And her housing search got down to the wire. She had to request extensions from Section 8 while she continued to be rent burdened, because she had a very hard time finding a landlord that would take the Section 8. So it was both involuntary displacement from an apartment that was just right for her, very close to her work, and then an increasingly desperate housing search for a working woman caring for an infirm mother in house. And it was just a prime example for me. Turns out it's the same landlord that's been, fined, except the $1 million suit or settlement with the Attorney General Cuomo's office for improper practices down in the city. And he was, in other words, able to do that here under cover of saying we don't accept Section 8. It's a prime example to me of that it continues to be a place where abuse can happen and where a real hardship results, and it does result.
Just another question before you go on. Does this committee, does the board, and more specifically, does this committee know specifically what the last comment, view, position of the monitor of the feds is with respect to source of income? Is it a, it was Mr. Ross properly pointed out the IP, the implementation plan for our complying with the terms of the settlement is due in a couple of weeks, and there are a wide variety of different items that have been discussed. has source of income been discussed in a way where we can assign a particular weight to it for purposes of of our review of the proposed legislation?
The settlement agreement provides that the county executive will actively promote enactment of source of income.
Right. Now, fast forward, with respect to the discussion that took place between the county and the monitor, subsequent to the submission of the implementation plan, has there been any elements of those of that discussion that have focused on source of income?
The implementation.
We need to be privy to it.
Mrs.
Myers just mentioned that we need to be.
The implementation plan included as an appendix the prior draft of the source of income law, not the current one that excludes co-ops or inheritance. It includes the prior draft and said attached is the prior draft and included the former county executive's letter saying, you know, I'm promoting this, I'm in favor of it. So that's what was submitted in the implementation plan. There is a letter from the monitor to the new county executive which commented on the implementation plan, as we know, and he submitted a report. And I don't think it made any detailed comments about the source of income law other than questioning when it was coming on for discussion.
Right.
But I don't have that. I didn't bring that letter in. We do have that letter. Mm-hmm. But as far as the discussions since the non-acceptance of the implementation plan by the monitor, we are not privy to those discussions, and we didn't hear anything today to, you know, about those discussions. Yeah. So.
Well, there's nothing. There's nothing we can do about, you know, the discussions that take place, and there will be from time to time things I suppose will be discussed that we will not be part of. But we're all aware, certainly around this table, that not because we want to, but the law says that we are to be an integral part of this going forward. And as there was a non-acceptance of our plan at the end of January, all of us are aware of the fact that that plan is still due, and our responsibility is to be a equal part in the preparation and submission of that. And we all know that we are we're not bystanders to be told what's going on inside the ballpark. All right, we need to be in the ballpark, on the field, participating. That is the decision that this board made when we took the documents that were put before us, the proposed legislation, and we decided to amend some and add an important part, which carved out a role for us. Early on, even with the old administration, there was tension early on as we quickly got them in line to have them understand that we had an integral working role in all of this. And that wasn't something that they were used to over 12 years, but we explained to them that that wasn't negotiable, that wasn't debatable, that was in the law. And I directed that the old administration, the new one is too new, and I have every reason to believe that they can read as well as we can, and they know what the law provides. But if some of these things that we talk about, source of income today, other topics down the road, if there are decisions that are made on these things that are made unilaterally, where we are not part of that, that's a problem with the process, as I see it.
You're absolutely correct. We passed a law when we approved the settlement, a local law that said that Board of Legislators will actively participate in the development of the implementation plan.
We have three members appointed, right?
Right.
We do.
But any other comments on this source of income law? I especially appreciate any comments on this concept or the issue of the interaction of the emergency tenant protection laws and Section 8, how they interact. Or this question of the ability, if we pass this law, the landlord to terminate at the end of a section of the lease. I'll tell you what we would like to do going forward, and that's why I would not put this on for a public hearing on March 22nd.
Right.
I would like, and we haven't had a chance to get back yet, but we have requested, Ms. Motalto, our committee coordinator, has talked to Nassau County and New York City, and we would like to get some feedback from both of those jurisdictions as to their experience with this law and, you know, how many complaints might have arisen once they passed the law, particularly with the Nassau Human Rights Commission. And we haven't gotten that information yet. And we actually would like to invite representatives of Nassau and New York City to come up and talk to us about how their law has worked.
How old is our law, John?
Their laws?
Yeah. How old is it?
Nassau, give me a second. Yep, you know the date on
it? I think it was 07. New York City was March 2008.
So they should have some.
7 and 8.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nassau really County was, I think, 2006. 2006 or 2007. So they have 3 years' experience at least.
Mm-hmm. So. What we're talking about then, John, if we have no other comments, would be to set the date specific when we sign this out for the April 5th meeting?
Yeah.
And giving us time up until then to do it?
Yeah, you have a question?
Why did we do that?
Well, because he said he didn't want to conflict with the 22nd. From the other jurisdictions.
Yeah, but Vito suggested that we set a public hearing date for the 5th of April at this point.
I
you want to wait until
we
have the March 22nd meeting?
Yeah,
well, we can do it then.
I asked the question, though. I didn't suggest
it. No, I agree.
He said he didn't want to have it the 22nd. He wanted it the meeting thereafter, which I am pointing out as April 5th.
Right. So let's have the meeting, and we could vote it out on March 22nd. But I'd like to wrap up some of these outstanding issues and get some feedback from those other jurisdictions.
All right. Then now my question again is, if we sign this out, we usually set a date specific and a time when we sign this out for a public hearing. And we will set the public hearing at the March 22nd meeting, not the next meeting, for April 5th.
Yes. That
is that what you'd like a motion to be? To set the public hearing, sign it out for
all? You don't think we should do it?
I don't think so.
I think we need to hear from
the testimony of those organizations that have got the experience with it. I think we should wrap the record before we make a
I agree. I agree. Anyone else?
I just asked a question.
Okay. No, good question.
Pull a messenger.
Fair question.
So we're not going to sign it out today for any public hearing.
Until we get this
additional
information. Okay. And we're in touch with both of those. Right.
Still working on the equity.
And anybody in either entity who wants to make a comment could feel free
to
write.
Frankly, I would also like to contact Connecticut, which is a state law, and see what if they have any interesting experience.
Yes, they have a state law.
Good idea. And then we get them in the near future.
Yeah. Next time. We have plenty of time to get them
New
in.
Jersey has it.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? Yes, sir.
Yes. I could comment. There was one question you asked about the relationship between Section 8 and ETPA in New York State. One of the things. Some of the documents, they suggest that this kind of source of income legislation is in other parts of the country, but no, outside of New York State, the other parts of the country don't have the ETPA law. And the ETPA law, as a result of the Rosario decision, as you correctly stated, indicates that once the Section 8 is considered a term and condition of the lease, you have to offer a renewal of the lease. And this is not the case in the rest of the country that doesn't have the ETPA law. So if you, for instance, accept a tenant, and I have Section 8 tenants, a number of them, probably 50 of them, so it's not like I'm totally against Section 8, if there's a problem, with the tenant, and the fact is you've accepted them, you've accepted, you know, whoever they are when you first, you know, were willing to sign a lease with them, and then you find there are some issues with them, then the way it operates in New York State, as long as they're under ETPA, it cannot be terminated at the end of the lease. And someone can say, well, if there are really problems with the tenant, you can go in and start a holdover proceeding and all that kind of stuff. But the reality is it's very difficult to do that. So the fact is that it's unique in New York State because of the ETPA. And comparing what we're going to do here to every place else really is not fair comparison.
The purpose of the comparison with the other jurisdictions is to find their experience with other aspects of how the law has been implemented, particularly looking at whether there's been a surge in complaints, discrimination complaints. I do agree with you, and that when this was raised last year, mm-hmm. there was we had ETPA. I don't think it was very clear as to what exactly the ramifications of that were, but we did some research. Our committee counsel, Betsy DeSoy, did some research, and we came up with the issue. The issue arises under the Rosario decision. Interestingly enough, there was a case decided by Judge Colangelo now in the county court, in the city court of New Rochelle, where he actually held the opposite of Rosario, but of course he's just the city court of New Rochelle, and this is the court of appeals that said it's a term of condition. So what I would like to do is ask the county attorney's office, who I see is here, if you could take a look at that and see if there's any way that we could somehow protect the landlord in that situation. I'm not sure we can, but it might be worth looking at. Where, because of the way ETPA works and makes Section 8, and Section 8 becomes a term and condition of the lease, that a landlord who is under ETPA and accepts Section 8 must renew a Section 8 tenant, whereas if they had Section 8 and not ETPA, they wouldn't have to renew the Section 8 tenant okay. at the conclusion
so
of the lease.
With
right. Yes, there's a question in the back.
Yes. As you just pointed out, when you have a Section 8 tenant in an ETPA apartment or just a regular ETPA tenant, an ETPA apartment, and there's a problem with that tenant, you can start a housing court case to evict them. You're not obligated to keep bad tenants in your apartment. But normally, because ETPA apartments are so valuable, if you just don't want to renew the lease at the end of the tenancy because a tenant has been a less than desirable tenant, by and large, those tenants are going to fight that anyways, the non-renewal of the lease. So one way or another, I mean, tenants are, especially in ETPA apartments, just because they're such wonderful apartments to live in, tenants are going to challenge that, whether or not they're Section 8 tenants.
They're not just going to move out when the lease is
You're
terminated.
Talking about the ETPA lease?
Yes, yeah. Okay. ETPA apartments. Tenants do not give up those apartments. They really try very hard to hold on to them, to comply with the leases, to not be bad tenants, because they know there are serious repercussions if they are out of compliance.
Yes, yeah, John, the fact that, the Section 8 tied to an ETPA apartment doesn't, bring any negatives to the ETPA tenancy. I mean, if anything, it brings a positive because there's a subsidy attached to it. Karen mentioned right, the tenants are more likely to behave in a better fashion.
Maybe that's true. Exploring the fact that when you combine these two programs together, it does result in a restriction of a landlord's right.
Well, if they're restricted on that ETPA, they've got to renew the ETPA tenancy on the same terms and conditions as expiring lease, whether they have Section 8 or not. Whatever the terms and conditions, they've got to renew that.
But if they had...
I think the real estate lobby is trying to unfairly single out that Section 8 is going to be the reason why they can't renew, they can't get out of these things. As Karen rightly says, they have a right to terminate if they're for cause.
But if they had just Section 8, the only point of this is that if they were mandating a landlord to accept Section 8 under certain circumstances, right? If they had Section 8, if under Section 8, they have the right not to renew a lease. And they would still have that right, even if we pass this law, arguably.
Not to renew the Section 8 contract. They have the right not to renew the Section 8 contract.
Right. If the tenant had the money to pay for the lease, but still up to the landlord to renew the lease or not.
In a non-ETPA building.
Right, non-ETPA. So the impact of having ETPA on top of this law would be to require the landlord to renew the lease when, without ETPA, if the landlord has Section 8, which is a voluntary program, they don't have to renew the lease. So we're kind of mandating that. That's the only thing I'm pointing out.
The way this law would change it would be, since you would essentially obligate us to rent it to this tenant by the law, you'd force us into the situation where we couldn't, it could be terminated. So it's like, once you get into it, it's like you're in a trap, you can't get out.
How is that different from any other tenant you have?
Because along with Section 8, it comes with the lease addendum, which has a whole bunch of of rules that are unique to Section 8.
Right.
So that's different than everything else. But it has to do with this whole source of income restriction, where you're making source of income a human right, which I fundamentally disagree with.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say, personally, that we're making it a human right. We're saying that if you're getting the money from the, if we're saying, I think what we're saying, what the law is suggesting is that there are funds there that are being provided so that the landlord, the rent's going to get paid. Mm-hmm. And you can't refuse to accept that tenant because part of the rent is coming from a government source. I don't know if that's creating a human right or not. I don't think so, but. Yeah.
The effect of this law is to create
It creates a right that doesn't. Right. You're right. It creates a right that doesn't exist. Yes, Mr. Rogowski.
I apologize for being late. Just one question. We've been through a lot of this before, but you know, there are a lot of practical implications of landlord-tenant law generally. I'm curious. One issue that I don't think we've discussed a lot in the past is I sort of call it family attribution rules. I sort of lost track of where the current status of the law is, but today, if you have ETPA tenants, and then there's a, you know, a brother or a sister or a son, or I mean, there's certain rules that if someone's a family's in there, if someone leaves, I think certain family members have the right to stay on. And assuming that's true, I sort of forget some of my law, but assuming that's true, how would that work? Because, you know, the landlord does certain underwriting, we've gone through the credit reports, but if the Section 8 office does the underwriting, if you will, the analysis of the Section 8 tenant. And then, as in the real world happens, brothers and sisters and aunts, uncles and children move in and out. And then if the section, something happens to the Section 8 tenant, but there's a sister or a son or daughter, do the same, would the rules apply that that person then gets to stay and potentially stays under Section 8? I mean,
Does it depend on who holds the Section 8 voucher?
Yeah. Or if not Section 8, but gets caught a right between ETPA and Section 8, because I believe the rules are certain family members sort of not inherit, just kind of under the landlord-tenant rules, get the right to stay in the apartment. Whether or not they were actually chosen by the landlord, it's like a family member. And I'm just curious.
That has nothing to do with source of income now, though.
Well, but with the same, but there's certain underwriting the landlord does today. If a Section 8 tenant has a relative move in, even if they don't necessarily have Section 8, but do they get to stay under those general rules?
I would think the Section 8. Does anyone like
but it's landlord-tenant rules as opposed to Section 8 laws. It's like a.
Under ETPA, there is a right of succession.
Right of succession.
Somebody's lived there, family members live there as their primary residence for a minimum of 2 years prior to the primary tenant either vacating or passing away. They would have the right to succeed. They wouldn't be able to assume somebody else who had a Section 8 voucher.
That not necessarily get the voucher, but they in the first instance, they would have a right to the apartment. They'd have to independently.
That's strictly on.
But they'd have to pay the rent.
They'd have to figure out a way. But they would have, in the first instance, they'd have a right to it, and then they'd have to figure out how to pay for it.
The right of succession. It means the next ETP needs to come in, it would have to be made in that person's name.
Okay. They may not necessarily get the Section 8, but they would have. Okay, but they have a right to the apartment if they can figure out a way to pay for it.
Yeah.
Well, they could theoretically go back to the federal, if not Section 8.
See, that's not something that the Section 8 program that would give them a greater right than they ever have.
No, but
they already have that right.
It just goes to the whole the landlord's decision making, the underwriting, the issues, you know, credit reports. All that. It goes to the big picture. That's all.
Okay. Any other?
I just heard us say they can't get Section 8, but if they qualify for Section 8 funding and they're in an ETPA by succession of rule,
they have to have a voucher. They have to get a Section 8 voucher.
I didn't say that. She said they can't get Section 8.
They don't inherit the voucher. They might be able to stay in the
even if there was no, if they can still go and apply for Section 8 under their own income and their own ability.
Yeah. Right. They would have to.
And a judge is going to say, while you're applying,
yes.
I had a situation where a tenant was on Section 8. She passed away, and the daughter was in the apartment.
Mm-hmm.
Succeeded to the apartment.
Under rent stabilization?
Under ETPA and under a Section 8 program. And the Section 8 program did also provide her with the Section 8 voucher. And so there was continuation. So the fact is...
There was no break, Mr. Nielsen?
There was no break. In other words, they just they changed the documentation.
They moved her.
Included her name as the person on the voucher after her mother died. So the idea is what Mr. Grassi is saying is that once you've accepted a tenant under Section 8 and under ETPA, you then have to follow all the rules of ETPA, especially
well,
having to do, you know, among other things, with succession. Mm. And so, you know, and you can continue on and ad infinitum, and may never stop.
Well, it's interesting what New York City apparently did, and Betsy, we can refer this to the county executive. When they passed their source of income law, they protected only people who were had rent control as of a certain date. So after that date, if you were a Section 8 tenant, am I right, mm-hmm. you didn't have the protection of the ETPA as far as renewal goes.
Right. That's New York City.
So we should look into that. You know, what we're trying to do is, I said at the beginning, to determine if there's any common, if there's how much common ground we could reach. And maybe there's a point where we can't reach any more common ground. You, Marty and Jim, you missed this. I said at the beginning that there's some philosophical differences here as to views of tenants' rights groups and views of landlord groups as to the rights of landlords and the rights of Section 8 voucher holders. What we're trying to do is see if there's enough common ground that we could reach the greatest possible consensus to pass legislation. We might not be able to reach total common ground, and there might be differences, but how far can we go to reach common ground, and how much support is there for legislation that tries to reach some accommodation? And I think Mr. Hanratty pointed out that, you know, tenants groups have given a lot, so the landlords groups think they've given a lot. And we'll see where we wind up. But the one thing we are going to do, which I hope we're going to do, and I am advocating, is that we vote on this, that it get voted on. I think it's a mistake just to keep discussing something forever and never vote on it. And it'll come for a vote. But we're going to do enough due diligence that we're going to try to get as much consensus as we can. And that's why we're exploring all the issues. Yes?
John, just a technical point on the printouts for Nassau County law. It ends on 261, but Title C2 hasn't ended. Is there more to the law, or was it just the salient parts of the law that were printed out?
That's what they had emailed me. They didn't want
we'll check
the
on
entire
that.
Document because it was so long.
So the actual statute might actually be...
Well, no, you know what? This is the entire, if I got the right document, it's the entire Nassau County Commission on Human Rights Law. And I think what they gave us is the parts that deal with, well, they gave us more than the part that deals with source of income. So I don't know why they cut it off at a certain point.
They started from the beginning and just gave us the...
Up to Title C, page 216. Can we double check that? You don't have to look. What he's saying is it ends on 261 with an employment agency sentence not being approved.
Yes,
we'll
check on that. Yes, Mr. Pinger.
I think the distinction should be understood that in New York City, it's only Section 8. And not any other sorts of income. I think our law, to my meaning of it, is much broader, including other sorts of income.
I just got here a few minutes ago.
We'll check that. Can we check that? The exact parameters of both?
I'm not sure.
I'll assume New York City provides assistance to disabled persons.
Well, some of things wrong.
I think the coverage of the law, though, that you're talking about in terms of the protection, only has to do with Section 8 in New York City.
This is the
New York
City definition for
source of
income.
Okay.
The definition in New York City is lawful source of income shall include income derived from Social Security or any form of federal, state, or local public assistance or housing assistance, including Section 8 vouchers.
Okay. But governmental assistance, not inheritance, not matrimonial payments.
No, that's an interesting difference. whereas our source of income...
Yes, Mr. Fingers, how that would affect...
Your definition is...
Well, our definition is lawful verifiable income derived from Social Security or any form of federal, state, or local public assistance or housing assistance, that including the federal housing subsidy known as Section 8. So that's the same. But then we go on and say disability payments, court-ordered payments, assistance grant or loan program from a private housing assistance organization, annuities, pensions, and child and spousal support.
Exactly.
So you think we go too far?
I think you go much too far.
I know we had a long discussion about private housing assistance organization. I think we that was specifically discussed last year, but I don't think we spend a lot of time on annuities, pensions, and child and spousal support. And we took out inheritance.
Mr. Chairman?
Why would they be?
Yes.
It might be, we didn't spend a lot of time last year. It might be helpful, the whole range of federal, state, local assistance. I know I'm aware of one form of assistance, which I think is helpful, the emergency. I've had the tenants come in, and for whatever reason, they fall a month behind, even 2 months behind, and they come in with some kind of DSS rental paper that the landlord needs to sign in order to get that emergency shelter payment. And that seems like, I think the landlord should sign that. I mean, I think that's an emergency. But we didn't, I'd like to get some testimony on that, and then the whole ramification, even from potentially someone's homeless. I mean, I don't know exactly what, if someone's homeless, what dollars are available on an emergency basis, but someone comes in and this person's homeless, we want to go in. I mean, is there a range of, so we understand the federal programs, because this is...
Can we get a list of what programs, I mean, I'm sure the tenant groups and the housing groups may have that list to help us with that, so we know what's there. Yeah. And what do we, why... question here about, I don't remember, but maybe somebody can answer why we decided to include annuities and pensions.
Included or
excluded? Included. Why we included annuities and pensions.
Well, because it's a perpetual source of income. It's better than holding a job with IBM right now.
But we're getting beyond government assistance, which was the original intent.
Well, that was a flashpoint, but there are other sources of non.
Well, no, John,
there's work.
There are several states that have source of income laws that exclude Section 8,
no,
so they certainly
no,
none.
That's
one
looking,
case,
really?
One Wisconsin court decision excluded.
Was it a court decision?
But I looked at all the others. If you want, I'll give them to you. Wisconsin, there was a court decision that said the term lawful source of income does not include Section 8. But the other statutes seem to include.
Does it have on our list? Yeah, do we have a list on here?
This is the list.
It's
in our packet. Yeah, it was in our packet. Right? Let's start
out. What's the thought out there about the issue raised by Mr. Finger about including things like pensions and annuities? Any thoughts, any comments?
Why would anybody want to exclude that?
Why do you have to make it the law then if nobody's excluding it?
Well, that is a question that we think we should ask Mr. Finger and Mr. Vincent. Why do you feel we went too far, sir, in including those specifications? When in fact, the lawyers on the table saying that's guaranteed income, and we shouldn't even put it in.
Well, first of all, that's one point.
You don't mind my asking through the chair?
No,
I apologize.
I can answer that for you. The second point is that, number one, you have things such as metropolitan income that are not clearly not guaranteed and are part of the legislation. Yeah. As far as pension and annuity income, it may be variable. It may not be set in amount. It may not be guaranteed. There may be any number of reasons why a landlord, a prospective landlord, would not want to take that type of income as the only income. Maybe legitimate, maybe the type of thing, but it should be the landlord's decision as to whether or not, looking at the economics of the situation, they feel it's appropriate to accept that as the income or appropriate amount to make it.
May I just ask one? You said matrimonial income?
I think that's
what it says, marital status.
No. The source of income includes child and spousal support.
It says child and spousal support. So that's in addition to the discrimination against somebody because they're single or divorced.
No, that's right. That's an addition.
That means
I just want to be sure.
Nobody wants to discriminate against anybody because of marital status or childhood status. That's part of the law. That's what we accept.
Yes, Mr. Harper.
To this point, thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember that we had asked certain... Originally, this was not in the law, and we had asked for clarification on certain issues, and it was added. And I see Dolores is here, and maybe you recall. Do you recall why that language was added? I know originally it was not in, or whether Stacey made. Stacey was.
It wasn't. We were asked to draft this law to include it,
right?
And we informed the board that this was going beyond what New York City had.
Right, I'm just asking what the history was.
The history is that we included it because the board asked that we include it when we drafted the law. For no other reason than that.
Because I seem to recall it was in response to someone's request for clarification on the original version of the law, which is why we put it in. So there was a history there. I don't know if it's documented in past minutes, but I do recall there was a history there.
Ms. Tannenbaum had a comment. Yes?
I think in one of the very first versions of this bill, it may be that the word verifiable wasn't there. Because landlords were concerned that we wouldn't be able to know that these payments would be regular and ongoing. So the word verifiable is in there to protect landlords from exactly that kind of situation where a payment is just a lump sum payment or a one-time payment, or it's going to be there for 3 months but not indefinitely. So that problem's already been addressed. And if a landlord has a problem with income that's coming in that he doesn't think is regular, then I believe that the landlord probably could deny a tenant if it looks like it's just a one-time payment or it's not going to be ongoing.
I don't think that's in there now. Verifiable doesn't mean ongoing.
It just means you can present a document.
It means you can verify that you're getting a certain amount at a certain point in time, but not that it will continue.
But then could that be, in terms of the business decision, without being challenged? I'm asking you guys. You deal with
it. I think it's your problem. Once you start this whole business decision, it's opening the door. It's like the floodgates of litigation. You're opening verifiable, obviously, is not regular. Verifiable means you go in and assure yourself that it is what it is. You have a whole ambit of
I only asked that because, I did attend the public hearing and I was at several of the meetings as a member of another committee. And I remember when that question came up and they added the word verifiable, I didn't hear any comments saying that's not a good part.
I don't think he's a bad thing to verify. He has no problem.
Okay.
Any other board members, committee members?
What's the next? John, did you explain,
is
there a schedule of...
the next step is, and this is another issue I would like to consider. The next step we've already discussed is we're seeking input from New York City and from Nassau County as to their experience with their source of income laws. How they're working.
Thank you.
In fact, we should talk to New York City about the ETPA aspect. And I assume Nassau County has the same issue. And also talk about whether there's been an increase in discrimination complaints since the passage of their laws. We're going to add an exclusion with respect to condos since we have co-ops, and I don't think there's any reason to differentiate between the two. And third, based upon this most recent discussion, and I'm going to ask our committee counsel to take a look at, compare, we know the New York City law doesn't go so far as to include annuities, pensions, and child and spousal support. I'd like to know if any of the other laws in the other jurisdictions we've looked at define source of income that broadly.
Okay.
Were you going to look, Mr. Chair, at Connecticut? You mentioned that
yes.
earlier, or
yeah.
not?
No, we will look at Connecticut.
Because,
we'll ask for input from Connecticut.
I thought there was a concern about other states not being compatible. Okay.
So that's all right. And we're going to do this on or before March 22nd.
And talking New York City, I think the statute in New York City dealt with new tenants, but I think there was a case law that sort of incorporated existing tenants. I'm wondering, now, does our statute differentiate?
What are you talking about specifically?
A new tenant coming in with a Section 8 voucher and how the landlord deals with that. And then I think there was a case, there was an existing tenant in someone's building who then received the voucher. But the statute, I think, only referred to new tenants. And I think it had to go to court, if I recall. In the court case, the judge included existing tenants, even though the statute itself didn't. So I'm just questioning, our law, are we covering, is the intent to cover new and existing? Because someone could be in the apartment for 5 years, lose their job, and then go apply for Section 8. They're an existing tenant. And I'm trying to recall now whether our, you know, what's our intent? Because the city, I think, intended to cover what the judge covered.
What you said, we can't make the decisions that the judges make.
Well, no, but we can say our law covers both. We can clearly say our law covers both.
Yeah.
Or just one or the other. The city law was sort of, I guess, silent, at least on as to existing tenants. Someone who was an existing tenant, I think, went to court about a year and a half ago, and I think the court ruled that they were covered. But I'm saying we shouldn't have, if we're going to do something, we shouldn't have to, like, leave up to a judge. We should, like, what do we intend? And just say what we intend. So I'm just asking the question.
Prospective or retroactive?
Do we intend just for new tenants or existing tenants?
Do you say that in the law, boss? Or do you just say everybody, which includes past and present.
So you're saying an existing tenant
some could be
gets a Section 8 voucher.
Right. They lose their job, they go get Section 8.
Right.
But they're an existing tenant. The New York City statute, if I recall, only explicitly applied to someone applying for an apartment, a prospective tenant coming in with a voucher.
Was that a date specific as of this date, anybody coming in?
The statute applied. No, even in the future, someone coming in to a building. But the court,
so it's from a
looking
date,
at it, I guess we're broad. Is anyone familiar with that? Am I making this up?
I can't find it in the law, but maybe...
Anybody familiar with that statute?
Yes.
Okay, Section 6 of the law, which talks about the effective date of the law.
This is our proposed law.
This is our law.
Section 6.
Yeah.
It indicates, because when we drafted this initially, it was requested that we make it effective immediately for current lessees, and that there be...
That's
180-day
right.
period
mm-hmm.
Before it applies for those who are, new tenants.
That's right. We did break it up.
That it applies to current as well as new tenants, but immediately to current lessees, and then
180-day
period before it applies to new
tenants. Thank you very much for clarifying that. I was trying to find that the New York City law did, but we'll take a closer look at that.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, have you discussed today, I apologize, I was elsewhere, whether
elsewhere, you're not going to tell us where elsewhere?
Meeting down the hall. Have you discussed the possibility of dealing with this concept in without amending human rights law and just a freestanding law? Has that been discussed?
No.
Can we investigate to see if that's a possibility? And where the other states and places have prohibited discrimination on the basis of source of income, do they all do it as an amendment to the human rights law, or they do it as freestanding?
Nassau did it as a human rights law amendment. I don't know that New York City did. They did too? Yeah. I don't know. We'll have to look at the other states.
Right. Because I would suggest that might be a compromise approach.
But where would a violation
where would you go?
If you had a violation?
We have to see what others do.
Well, let's follow through. In our case, where would we do it?
I'm not sure. I want to see how the others, because we have a lot of laws where you prohibit something, and then it's either self-enforcing or it's enforced by a prosecutor, by a government agency, by whatever.
Well, I think that would create a greater
burden.
Then you do fines.
Well, I don't know. Let's see what the alternatives are, because unhooking it from the Human Rights Commission might make it more acceptable to those who have problems with it.
Assume it were passed. Would you rather have it in the Human Rights Commission
I think
or some other enforcement?
We have to think about that. I'm not
Well said.
I'm just going to answer that one off the top of my head. Well said. I don't know what the ramifications would be in having a separate law.
We've got a couple of months. We're going to be looking into that.
I'll tell you one thing, though, that the New York City law, I think, has a maximum of a $5,000 fine.
Yeah.
And I think your law has a $100,000 fine.
Right.
And I think that is a significant difference in terms of enforcement. I don't know why it would be for the freestanding law, whether it be a violation, whether it be an ALJ, or whatever.
Well, there are all kinds of models. I mean, we do have health department and sanitary code violations where you do have an ALJ. There are other types of statutes where we regulate things. I mean, we have stuff under...
Off the top of my head, Connecticut does it through a Human Rights Commission. Maryland does it through its fair housing law. So that's two right there.
No, but the fair housing law is not necessarily a Human Rights Commission. They could have a separate board.
But our fair housing law is in our Human Rights Commission law.
Right, but I'm just saying, they may do a different way. I'm not sure how the others do it.
Well, we'll take a look at that. That's one of the, since we have all the other laws.
Right.
Oregon does this.
Oregon then was
what? You caught me.
That's Oregon.
1437F is Section 8?
I assume that's what it is.
We'll check.
So we're going to get all that information for a future meeting.
Right.
Hopefully in time to sign this out for the March 22nd meeting to set a date future.
Well, why don't we aim to get this information by March 15th, since it may take some time. So by the
that would dovetail with the
March 15th, we will hopefully get this information.
So that's the week before the March 22nd, so you can sign it out to be set a hearing at the 22nd for whatever date in the future you wish.
Right.
Okay.
That's assuming it's the right assumption.
Any other questions or comments? Everybody have any question about where we're going from here?
Not sure.
Yes.
From the city, I'm wondering who you're intending to invite. I mean, I work closely with colleagues in the city, and I know there's a reason why there have been a lot of complaints, is that it's still very blatant. They blatantly don't comply. If you go on things like Craigslist and stuff, I mean, you'll see ad after ad after ad, no Section 8, no Social Security,
bike racks,
blah, blah, blah. I'm just wondering who you're going to bring in, because I have plenty of colleagues who can attest to, you go on the internet, you'll see that there's a lot of complaints because there's no compliance.
Well, I thought we were going to bring in someone from the agent from the
enforcement
in New housing. York enforces this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? So we're all clear on, if we could circulate, Melanie, a list of all the to-dos, mm-hmm. follow-up items, so that we all know, to the board, and to anybody else who's interested, so we know where we're going. But our aim is March 15th.
And if there's any suggestions to change this, we would discuss it at the time.
Yeah, I think we're going to take a look at and compare these other sources, the source of income provisions, the definition that we have compared to other jurisdictions to see why we, how far beyond them we go and why. We talk about why.
Want a motion to adjourn?
I also specifically ask the housing and tenant community what your views are on having pensions, annuity, and spousal support in there in the definition of source of income.
Or should Mr. Finger didn't want to comment on it, but I don't think we should be forcing
the question. No, I'm not asking you to do it now. I'm not asking you to do it now, but I'd like to get comments on that issue before March 15th. No, I'm not asking you to do it now. Okay, good.
There are no minutes.
Adjourn.
I so may.
For a second, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Good morning. When we meet, I have a
I don't know.
So I just want to get to know this one-on-one.
We have to get to
know. Not that we're not going to squeeze it. We just got to learn.
Just look at this list. Let me go.
No, you guys should.
All right. Fine. As soon as we go at 10:31.
All right. Let me go look at it. All
right. Fine.
We're getting off.
Yes.